And welcome back, Jim, to El Paso Primetime. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Dennis. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Your book is the third in a series, Counting Down, and this time around, the Rolling Stones gets your perusal, I would like to put it mildly, to say the least. It's an interesting read. I love the way that you've actually analyzed every one of the 100 songs on this countdown.
Thank you very much, Dennis. You know, it's the Rolling Stones are a group that I've always admired. You know, I don't think I could write a book like this without being a big fan of an artist. And so to be able to go through this catalog and really dive into it and try to separate these great songs, it's been a labor of love.
When you have the notion to do something like this, like you did with Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, you find yourself immersed in a style of music that is just unique. It's not blues, it's not rock, it is everything, though.
It's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that has a lot to do with what makes these certain artists special, is that they can take all these different influences and kind of put them in a blender, and they get filtered through the different sensibilities and the talents in the band, and then it comes out sounding unique. And, you know, the best artists are able to do that, and certainly, you know, I feel like the first two of my books, the artists profiled by them, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan, you say that about them, and you could certainly say that about the Rolling Stones, and that, you know, when you hear a Rolling Stones song, yeah, you could maybe point out some blues influences and some country influences or whatever the case may be, but more often than not, it comes out sounding like the Rolling Stones, and that's a sound all its own.
You know, you went into an entire catalog of Stones albums, things you took me back to my own childhood and my adolescence and early adulthood, and I kept thinking, my gosh, how did I miss this? How did I miss that? For instance, Star Star from Goat's Head Soup, I completely forgot about the album in of itself.
Yeah, that's a song that's one of the more controversial, and, you know, the Stones came out with a lot of controversial songs over the years, and some of them, you know, I think they did it just for controversy's sake, and those I could kind of take or leave. But Star Star, you know, it is what it is, kind of calling out groupies and, you know, name-dropping some very famous people, but it's a great song. You know, it's got that Chuck Berry kick that the Stones have gone back to time and again, and, yeah, that's maybe one that people forgot about a little bit. I think Goat's Head Soup is an album, you know, that maybe is a little underrated or not thought of as much. But it's a fun song, and if you could, you know, you could kind of, you know, look past the political incorrectness of it, you really enjoy it.
You know, I remember the album cover and Jagger looking like Hepburn.
He absolutely did, yeah. And the Goat's Head Soup was, you know, I think the thing you get out of Goat's Head Soup is a little bit of fatigue. You know, they sounded a little bit tired. They had been such an amazing run. And that's the album where maybe it starts to catch up with them a little bit. But yet, there's some really great ballads on that album, like Winter and Angie, just to name a few.
Oh, my goodness gracious. When you talk about Angie, you hit a number of chords in my soul. You know what I mean? It's just one of those songs that when you hear the very open of the song, it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful opening with Keith playing the acoustic guitar, and I believe that was Nicky Hopkins on piano, and, you know, just the music is so gorgeous, and then, you know, Mick starts to sing, and it's just this really melancholy, pretty song, and, you know, that's the thing about the Stones. You know, everybody kind of stereotypes them as rockers, and that's all true, and they're very brash, but then they reach back for some of the most moving ballads, really, in rock and roll history.
Do you think that's what's missing, really and truly, with some of the metal bands and some of the more pronounced bands of the 90s and of current day, that they don't have that kind of an edge?
Yeah, I think that's a lot to do with it. I think, you know, a lot of it comes down to songwriting, too. And again, I think that's an underrated part of the Stones, and I think that comes out over and over again in the book, is that, you know, if you have the songwriters who are versatile enough to kind of bounce around and try different things, and, you know, the Stones had that, you know, and you, of course, people know Mick Jagger, and he's out in front, but they also had Keith Richards writing the music and sometimes the lyrics to a lot of these songs. And so having these two songwriters coming at it from different perspectives, trying different things. I think that might be what some bands lack. You know, you don't see too many bands anymore with two songwriters who are kind of sharing the credits, like, you know, Jagger and Richards, and obviously Lennon McCartney is the other, you know, the very prominent one. And I think that adds a little bit to the stew, kind of. And, I think that a lot of newer bands, they just don't have that same kind of dueling perspective that the Stones had.
There's something else to be said with that kind of yin and yang of songwriting and whatnot. At least you don't have the constant battle for supremacy inside the band, or at least not outwardly.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think Jagger and Richards, you know, they out in public sometimes, you know, they'll throw their little barbs at one another, and that's all part of the game. I think that's part of the image, too. I think that's why they do that. But I think they realize that they bring something to each other's work that, you know, they've had solo careers, and they've been okay, but nothing like what the Rolling Stones have been able to do. And you know, it goes down to that songwriting combination. It also goes down to the chemistry, but, you know, the musical chemistry, which also, I think Charlie Watts, being a member from the start all the way through, I think he has a lot to do with that as well. So I think it's a combination of different things. It's just that indefinable thing you call chemistry that some bands have and some bands don't. The Rolling Stones have it in spades.
One of the things that I really like to look at when I see the Stones through the years, Charlie Watts' drumming has always been something that has always piqued my curiosity. A jazz drummer who gets into this rock and roll band and suddenly thrust into this huge arena rock kind of a thing, and you still get to feel like he'd rather be in a quintet sitting in some little nightclub in Soho just doing his thing.
Yeah, you get the feeling that the Stones job pays the bills, but that's, you know, maybe not where his passion is. And yet, just one of the great rock drummers in the world, and, you know, able to essay all kinds of different styles, you know, took on disco with Miss You and hit that out of the park, can do kind of, you know, a real, you know, heavy kind of rocker like Paint It Black, where he's just bashing the heck out of those drums, and then can do something really delicate like Moonlight Mile, where, you know, his playing is just on that ballad. It's just mesmerizing. And, you know, Mick and Keith are out in front, but the backbone is Charlie Watts. And without him, you know, the Rolling Stones aren't what they are today.
There's something to be said about number 94, Sister Morphine. It's off of the Sticky Fingers album from 71. I was a senior in high school when that came out. And people had a lot to talk about back in the day, that it was maybe a sick portrait of Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah, Marianne, and it's funny because Marianne, you know, she was part writer of the song and had to battle Jagger and Richards for credit for many years before they finally relented and gave her a co-writing credit. And that's tough to get out of the Jagger Richards duo, because they're fiercely protective of those songwriting credits. And you know, Marianne Faithfull, she, and I talk about it in the essay, is that she actually wrote it when she was still kind of clean and, you know, didn't have these problems, and the song kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy for her, because she eventually did, you know, get heavily into drugs and had to really battle through it before coming out the other side. So it's an interesting song, you know, to have that, you know, different songwriter come in, and the Stones do a great job with it on what I feel might be their very best album.
How long did it take for you to collect the 100 based on this vast discography that they've got?
Yeah, it was a long process, because, you know, whenever I do it, I go through every single song, every single album, and even if I've heard it a million times, I'll listen to it again. And so with the Rolling Stones, you're talking about a lot of material. You're talking also having to dig, because in the 60s there were British albums and there were American albums, and some songs were on the UK and some songs were in the US, so really having to make sure that I was thorough enough to not leave any songs behind. And so, you know, that's probably a process of several weeks of just listening through, cataloging them, making notes, and giving them each a little preliminary rating, so that then I can take them and separate them into larger groups and sort of break it down that way. And then it's a matter of just, once I do that, making a preliminary ranking, I look at the ranking and I say, okay, is this all right? You know, maybe this song needs to be higher. I think I underrated this song, and going through it like that. And then eventually I just have to kind of sign off on a final ranking that I can live with, and you know, then I begin the writing process.
It seems like a basic lesson for music journalists everywhere is to be able to sit down and take the time to listen to your product before you even put pen to paper, or in this case, fingers to keyboard.
Well, absolutely, Dennis, because I think the thing that happens is with so many of us, and I'm guilty of this as well, you know, we listen in the car and we listen at home and, you know, we're doing other things. And, you know, so the music can become wallpaper at times, especially the songs that are played the most. You know, you hear Satisfaction so often, or Sympathy for the Devil, or whatever the case may be, any one of their huge hits. And, you know, you have it kind of in your mind's eye and your mind's ear, I guess would be the way to say it. And you're not really listening to it, you know, intensely. And that's the one thing about this process is that, you know, that I enjoy so much is that I go through and every one of these songs, you know, there's nothing else on, there's no computer, there's just me with a pen and a pad and listening to these songs for every detail I can get. And you hear all the different things that these artists are trying to do, and, you know, the, you know, a little instrumental flourish here, you know, why does he choose this lyric there? And you know, for me, that's the real fun of this, of these projects, is to be able to go through it like that, even with artists like the Stones, who I knew so well going in. You know, I discovered so much.
You know, I would love to be able to write a book about the 1960s and the production process that went on during that hit period, I guess 1964 to 1969, you know, where you have the prolific strings and the unusual arrangements that you had and split tracks and the whole nine yards. I'd love to sit down and write something about that. I've just been enthralled with that period for some reason.
Yeah, and the Rolling Stones, you know, they took advantage of that as much as anybody. And, you know, Andrew Lou Goldham was kind of their producer in the 60s. I'm not sure he was that hands-on of a guy. You know, he tried to get involved with it, sometimes overproduced. But, you know, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were heavily involved in the production as well. And, you know, the Stones went through the era where, okay, the Beatles are trying all these things, we're going to try all these things. And a lot of times that worked out great. You think of a song like Paint It Black, you know, a lot of the a couple of the songs out there, Satanic Majesty's Request, where it all really came together. And plus the Stones had a secret weapon in Brian Jones in that period who could play all these exotic instruments and really add something to it. But then they kind of found their footing when they went back to the roots-based rock and roll. And yet even in that genre, they were able to innovate. You think of Keith Richards and songs like Street Fighting Man and Jumpin' Jack Flash kind of miking his guitars in a different way to get just this explosive sound. So, you know, the Stones were a big part of that era where, you know, okay, here's the studio, you know, let's use every inch of it, let's try different things and come up with something really special. And, you know, I think a lot of that is lost now because, you know, you have Pro Tools and all this stuff, and some of the innovation gets lost, and the Stones were really innovators.
Do you think there was a lot of competition? Do you think competition actually drove the Stones' music in that time period against the things like the Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, the whole gamut, even Jefferson Starship or Jefferson Airplane back in the day, Grateful Dead. Everybody was trying to innovate, and it seemed like everyone was competing for that number one slot on the top 40 charts.
Yeah, I absolutely think that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, the Stones, I think they were the ones that, you know, in one way they were competing against the Beatles because, you know, yeah, everybody kind of competed against the Beatles, and they were the ones, you know, kind of set against the Beatles because they had the bad boy image and the Beatles had the cleaner image, even though, you know, a lot of that was just, you know, that was just the perspective of the fans. It wasn't really like that. But in another way, the Stones were kind of the ones that you had to knock off the block because they had kind of grabbed this foothold of this roots-based music. You know, they were the blues, they were the white blues band. And so, you know, then you had that really, you know, live British blues scene that really erupted in the 60s. And, you know, but the Stones were the ones who were having hits while they were doing all that, too. So I think, yeah, I think competition, you know, always plays a role in any scenario like that. And Jagger and Richards, you know, they might come off in interviews as, oh, you know, they kind of come off as, you know, laissez-faire and things like that. But they were as hungry as anybody else to prove that the Stones were the best band in the world.
You know, as a record buyer back in the day, I would always have to choose between a Cream album, Brian Auger and the Oblivion Express. Gosh, you know, they're just the gamut. And I always went back to a Stones album.
Yeah, and, the, you know, the thing is, the Stones albums, there was very little filler. And, you know, so you're always getting your money's worth. Even when they were just, okay, we don't have any more originals, let's toss off a blues number here, an old blues number. And yet they would do it with that personality and you know, their own spin on it and really make it mesmerizing. So that's the thing about Stones albums, especially once you get to about 1968, where you start that run with Beggar's Banquet and Let It Bleed and Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street. I mean, those four albums, I mean, you just can't find a hole in those four albums. And I make the case in the book that, you know, you could put that run of four albums up against anybody's. And I'm a huge Beatles fan. I'm, you know, Dylan and Springsteen, obviously, and anybody else in rock and roll. But I don't know that you could put four albums back to back to back up against the four albums the Stones had there and come out on top.
It seemed like Exile on Main Street was actually the one of the four that you mentioned that propelled them into a different stratosphere away from everybody else, and suddenly the Stones were in a class all by themselves.
Yeah, it was, and it's such a different album. You know, even listening to it today, the production was so different than what you were used to hearing, especially at that time. It was the start of kind of progressive rock and all these intricate kind of sounds and synthesizers and everything kind of separated in the mix. And here comes the Stones, and Jimmy Miller was the producer at that time, and he had a lot to do with that success, but everything was kind of piled on top of each other. So when you listen to those songs, you know, you catch a horn blaring out here and there, and then a guitar lick comes out, and, you know, the vocals sometimes get buried in the mix. In fact, to this day, Mick Jagger, you know, he kind of downplays Exile on Main Street because he doesn't think the mix was that great. But I think he's missing the point because, you know, you just hear that music. It's so deep and profound. And, you know, it's an album that you keep going into. It's a double album, and you find new things all the time. And you're absolutely right, Dennis. I mean, that album, there's nothing like it, really, in rock and roll history. I don't know if you could say it's the best or second best, whatever you can say, but certainly there's nothing like it.
So when they released this album again in 2010, there's a track that you have in the book that surprised me because I had never thought about it as a Hot 100, so to speak. But I remember listening to it over and over and over again on the iPod because I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that this thing was seemingly like a little Frankenstein of a song.
Yeah, that would be Plundered My Soul, because I guess what you're talking about, number 31 on the countdown. And, yeah, it's amazing. First of all, it's amazing that the song never saw the light of day in the first place. But this is the Rolling Stones. I mean, they're known for that. They kind of have a lot of cutting room material. I mean, they had a turned a whole album cutting room material into a classic with Tattoo You. But Plundered My Soul, just kind of sitting there, and when they go in to do the reissue, they, you know, Mick Jagger kind of cleans it up, and they bring Mick Taylor back to add a guitar part, which I thought was really classy of them because he had played on the original. And, you know, the amazing thing about that song, and I talk about it in the book, is that Mick Jagger's doing this in 2010, and he somehow gets back into that space of 1972 again. I mean, you'd never know that this was a new vocal. It seems like it was done back there at Keith's Nelcote Villa, like all the other songs from Exile on Main Street. So that was a really special treat. And there's several songs on that reissue that are just amazing. You know, you might even argue that's better than the newer stuff that the Stones have come out with.
Yeah, Following the River. You've got that as number 53, and that one too. When you look back at the production aspects of how you put together stuff now, and you mentioned Pro Tools and all that, and back in the day when you had to run at least three or four three-track recorders in order to get your multi-track going?
it's amazing, yeah. And, you know, you're absolutely right. Following the River, another one. And I think those songs, you know, that's why, you know, I hope this book, you know, you're right. These songs sometimes slip by, you know, and those are two songs that are absolutely worthwhile being included in this tremendous list. And so I hope, you know, that when people read this, then they go back and they say, well, you know, Following the River, I never heard of that. And they listen to it, and I think they're going to get a real treat.
Well, it's like your other two books, Counting Down Bob Dylan's Hot, you know, 100 Finest Songs and Bruce Springsteen's 100 Finest Songs. You go back and read your earlier works and you start discovering music all over again. I think that's the most beautiful part about it is that music is so portable now. You can take it anywhere and then relive a childhood.
Yeah, absolutely, Dennis. And, you know, one of the things that I set out to do when writing this, you can go and find magazines and other books that are similar to these in that, you know, Rolling Stone always does lists, and magazines will do lists of certain artists. And, you know, sadly, with David Bowie passing, you saw a lot of them popping up, top 20 David Bowie songs or what have you. And a lot of times what they do is they get a consensus, and that's fine. But what I think happens is then you kind of end up with the greatest hits. And so I think the advantage of having just this one person do it is, okay, yeah, it's my kind of opinion on the thing, and you know, it's just one man's choice, and music is absolutely subjective. But I think it brings these other songs, these somewhat unheralded songs, back into view. And so I hope that's what it does. And, you know, that was one thing that I set out to do when I started writing these, and I hope I did it with the Dylan book and the Springsteen book, you know, those very extensive catalogs as well, because you can find in the nooks and crannies these amazing songs that not everybody knows about. In fact, maybe only the diehard fans know about.
Well, you know, we're into the 75th birthday of Bob Dylan. That was your first endeavor into writing something about 100 finest songs, and the collection on that particular volume is just drop dead gorgeous.
Oh, well, thank you. And you know, like I Bob Dylan was the one that kind of broke this open for me, because it started as a blog. And, you know, I think I did 200 on the blog, and it got such a nice response from Dylan fans who found it, and they said, a lot of them said, well, you should try this as a book. And I'm thinking, you know, who is going to try this as a book? And luckily I found the publisher in Roman Littlefield that wanted to kind of follow this vision that I had, and so that one's very special to me. And Dylan is, you know, Dylan is Dylan. He is absolutely one of a kind, and he's a genius. And, you know, I think the people will be looking at him someday the way that people look at Shakespeare now.
Same to be said about Bruce Springsteen, and that would be your second endeavor into 100 Finest Songs. There's something I want to go back to. I know we're talking about your current endeavor, counting down the Rolling Stones, their 100 Finest Songs, but I want to go back to Bruce Springsteen.
Sure.
The tune Blinded by the Light, that really piques my – after I saw number 41 in your book, I went back and I listened to it after we had spoken about the book and you know the Dylan work as well. I went back and listened to Blinded by the Light, the original version from Springsteen, and then went to Manfred Mann's version and tried to even the two of them out, and I always went back to Springsteen. And I'm not sure exactly why, other than the authenticity of what Blinded by the Light meant to me seemed more palatable from Springsteen than the rehash and the top 40 hit from Manfred Mann. Why would you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it just comes down to the Springsteen song is a little bit more relatable. You know, the message is more relatable coming in Springsteen's version. It's kind of a ramshackle version, maybe not produced that great, but there's a lot of emotion in the lyrics and things like that. And Springsteen makes you believe that he went through all that stuff, even as crazy as those lyrics are. He makes you believe that he was in the middle of it witnessing it all. And the Manfred Mann version, you know, I give them a lot of credit because they took a song that probably wasn't that radio-friendly. They completely transformed it into, you know, kind of this prog rock thing. And they made it something that, you know, when I hear it on the radio, I listen to it because I get a kick out of it. It's totally different from the Springsteen thing, but it's innovative, and it's taking one song completely redoing it and coming out with something new, something completely different. So that's what I look for in a cover version, is when somebody just, you know, tries something new. But that said, I think to get the real emotion of the song and get the full impact of the lyrics, I think you have to go back to the Springsteen version.
I really do agree. When I heard the Manfred Mann's version, when I was working at radio in Amarillo, Texas, the one thing that struck me about it is it seemed almost like a parody of the song.
Absolutely, yeah. It's on, and then they did it again with another Springsteen song. I believe they did For You,
yeah.
Which is very similar. You know, kind of this kind of over the top thing. And at the time, that was kind of what was in vogue as far as rock and roll was concerned. This big kind of arena rock sound with heavy production and things like that. So yeah, that's the thing. You know, some Springsteen fans will be like, "Oh, you know, that's silly," and it's a shame that that's Bruce's only number one hit, because it did go to number one, and that's the only one written by Springsteen. Springsteen, that went to number one. But to me, it's more power to Man for Man for seeing this song by Springsteen, you know, kind of changing it all around and coming out with something new. So I have no problem with that.
Well, let's go back to your current work, counting down the Rolling Stones, their 105 finest songs. There's a piece in here, Ruby Tuesday, and you mentioned that it's the U.S. version from Between the Buttons.
Yeah, a lot of times with the albums of the Rolling Stones, I have that in the index, is that you have these so many different, the songs are essentially the same, but they show up on different albums. And so in the case of Ruby Tuesday, it didn't show up on a British album until a Greatest Hits, I believe. And so I used the U.S. version, the U.S. album of Between the Buttons, because the Between the Buttons in the U.K. did not have Ruby Tuesday, and so to kind of juice up the American release, they put Ruby Tuesday, which was a bona fide hit. You just heard that song once, and you knew it was a hit. And so that kind of shenanigans went on at the record company back then, and the Beatles had the same kind of thing going on, where there would be American versions of the albums. And so to try to clarify it for the people who are reading who might want to seek it out, because if they went to look for Between the Buttons, the UK album, Ruby Tuesday is not on there, but it is on the US version of that album.
So it's almost, well, it's not exactly buyer beware, especially if you're buying Stones material, but it certainly is one of those things that you're going to start looking for those little rare treasures that are hidden in each one of the albums, whether it's a UK release, a US release, German release. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly this is in the 60s, that time period, you really have to look for that, because that was when there were these competing things. Like the Beatles, eventually the Rolling Stones got control of it, and then the U.S. and the U.K. albums were always the same. I believe probably Beggar's Banquet was the first one that was like that. And so from then on, then you could be pretty safe. But in those early ones, sometimes you kind of had to look, and there were B-sides and all kinds of things. That was one of the things about the research, was that I really had to be thorough. The Beatles had it all kind of collected. They had the past masters collections for the songs that didn't quite fit on albums, so that's a little bit easier to corral. The Stones, it was a lot of looking through online and then making sure that I got every single song in there.
People who want to get a hold of you can get a hold of you through Facebook?
Yeah, they can check me out on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Jim Bevilia. Last name is Beviglia. And as far as the books, there's also my website, by the way, countdownkid.wordpress.com, in which I do this on kind of a smaller basis for other artists and things like that. And as far as the books, if you just Google them, look them up, they're all available on any online bookseller, whether it's Barnes & Noble, Amazon, any of the major ones, you can look it up. And I hope people check this out, go back through the next ones. And the good thing, Dennis, we talked a little bit about the Beatles, is that's next on the list.
Oh, beautiful. Then you and I are going to have another conversation, Jim.
I'm looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Jim Bevilia has been our guest on El Paso Primetime. Mi casa su casa, young man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Dennis. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.